title of the program, I've added the "and efficient" part, but that's actually going to be somewhat de-emphasized. I'm going to focus on the highly accurate part. And this talk, I should warn you at the outset, this talk is, in some sense, a technical talk. There's no exciting new physical results. It's mostly about some of the little nitty-gritty details that one finds out the hard way and that one needs to know to make these things work. So, in view of the audience and the time, I think I can skip over why we care about high accuracy. But it's worth noting something about LISA M resources that I have not seen mentioned anywhere in print, although it may be well known to the cognoscenti, which is that the strongest LISA M resources are likely to have quite high signal-to-noise ratios, depending on various parameters. These could be up to 2,000 to 1 after matched filtering. And the implication of that, of course, is that if you'd like to do matched filtering after having found a LISA source to study it, test whether the central space-time is really curved, et cetera, you need very good waveform templates. And particularly, you'd like to know things like the self-force to a part per million or better. And that's sort of the working goal I have, is try and compute the self-force to a part per million or better. It's also worth noting that the sort of orbit correction scheme that many people have been talking about here, one of the reasons we want to do orbit correction is to get a handle on second-order effects. That means we need to be able to distinguish second-order effects from numerical errors in the first-order effects. That basically means we have to have the first-order effects pinned down to a relative error that's less than the mass ratio, which again leads us, if we want a bit better for a safety margin, that leads us to trying to get things to in the order of a part per million. And the argument for efficiency is, I think, so painfully obvious it needn't be said. So I think I can skip over the Barak-Ori mode sum regularization formalism and how it works. Everyone here knows all that stuff. When one does the mode sum regularization, one, of course, only computes a finite set of modes, and one estimates the tail terms. For later use, I'm abbreviating the basis functions for the tail as F sub P, where P is the order. I'll come back to those later. As most of you will know, I'm using an adaptive mesh refinement scheme to try and get the highly efficient part of this work. At the moment, it's a characteristic adaptive mesh refinement scheme. The moment it's using fourth order finite differencing, the greater than or equal to there is because I'm planning to, I suspect I'll need to go to sixth or eighth order to get sufficient efficiency to do orbit correction nicely. I've now instrumented the code to record how much faster it is than a unigrid evolution at the same equivalent resolution. It's typically a factor of 30 or 40 faster. In some cases, the speed up gets as high as 300, but that's mostly because, for reasons that will become clear later, those unigrid things would be anomalously slow. So you gain a lot of efficiency. In terms of what we talked about in the morning discussion session, with AMR, the CPU time essentially scales with the length of the particle world line. So for a 1 plus 1D code, it scales linearly with the problem domain size, not quadratically like you'd have for a unigrid code. So this means that you can get away with using very large domains at a cost which is merely irritating rather than overwhelming. I've done simulations, some of the results I'll be showing you used a problem domain size of 100,000 M squared, on 100,000 M on each side for the L equals 0 mode, for instance. And even so, that L equals 0 computation was only about 15% of the total computation for that resolution. We talked in the morning discussion section about the issues about, people talked about first do a low resolution calculation, then feed that back into a higher resolution calculation so that you reduce the initial data transient so it damps out faster. You can get that effect essentially for free once you have adaptive mesh refinement. You simply don't turn on the adaptive mesh refinement until after the code's run for a while. So I typically evolve in unigrid for 100 M or so, then I start turning on the AMR gradually. So I don't waste high resolution, which is expensive, on the junk initial data transient dying out. So there's a lot of benefits for it. Of course, there's lots of messy implementation complexity. And the details are all in this paper that you could find on GRQC. The source code is included as a tar archive with the GRQC paper if you want to look at it or play with it. So moving on to the new results here. Some of the results I'm going to show, it turns out that floating point round off is a significant error source in actually solving the weight equation for each L and M. The rounding error and the per grid point computation actually limits the accuracy I can reach at some of the higher accuracy runs. And the problem is, when you see that your results don't look quite right, is it floating point round off? Is it an unrelated problem? Is it a bug in the code? It's hard to tell. So to quantify this, I've implemented an alternate version of the code which uses extended precision floating point arithmetic, basically 80-bit floating point instead of 64-bit floating point. This basically cuts the rounding errors by a factor of 2 to the 11, about 2,000, at the cost of making the code run about twice as slow. It also uses about twice as much memory, but the memory usage is tiny anyway. It's never more than a few tens of megabytes, so that's not a serious concern. For the results I'm going to talk about, the sort of test parameters, I'm looking at a scalar field particle in a circular geodesic orbit in Schwarzschild at a radius of 10 aerial mass radius. The main focus of this talk will be on what I've learned from doing a large series of calculations with these same parameters using a wide range of different numerical accuracy parameters. I varied the adaptive mesh refinement tolerance over 5 orders of magnitude from 10 to the minus 14 down to 10 to the minus 19. Plus, I've also added fixed mesh refinement for technical reasons which are explained in the paper, but I'll omit here in the interest of time. And I'm using these so that I can make comparisons between the calculations at different resolutions to better estimate my numerical errors. For the calculations I'm doing here, these are all of the numerical parameters are chosen to try and optimize the high accuracy case. So I've chosen to solve up a rather large number of multipole modes. I'm going up to L equals 30, and I'm also doing L equals 35 and L equals 40 just to get a larger sort of x-axis range for the tail fit. The numerical force is summing modes up to 30, and the tail fit is using the modes between 20 and 30. To reach my goal of being better than a part per million, it's not enough to just fit the 1 over L squared or 1 over L to the fourth. I also need 1 over L to the sixth terms in the tail series. Since I'm using a circular particle orbit, I don't have to fit the 1 over L squared term. It's given by a somewhat messy formula in terms of Gaussian integrals from a paper by Detweiler, Messer, Otake, and Whiting. However, since the whole reason to use time domain methods rather than frequency domain is that one would like to generalize to highly eccentric particle orbits, where it's not clear that you can always fit, where you can always determine the C2 coefficient analytically. I mean, I've seen Eric has determined it in some work, but I noticed Lior hasn't in some other work. So if the experts disagree, I've done it both ways. So I've considered both the case where I fit the C2 coefficient and the case where it's known analytically. But in the interests of keeping our meeting on time, I'm only going to talk today, both sets of cases are discussed in the paper, but I'm only going to talk today about the case where C2 is known analytically and only C4 and C6 are fitted. Error estimates are sort of the number one theme of this talk. When you compute an individual cell force mode in the mode sum formalism, you compute it twice. You have an inside and an outside formula, basically whether you do the directional derivative of the field coming in from the outside or going out from the inside, because there's a jump discontinuity in the derivative at the field. These answers should be the same analytically. Of course, numerically, they're not. It turns out the difference between them is a very nice error estimator for the numerical calculation. It's very handy because this gives you an error estimate that comes out of a single calculation. A single mesh evolution. In fact, you don't need mesh refinement for this. This works fine in UniGrid as well. A single evolution of a single LM mode thus gives you the regularized regularized force mode, F sub L reg, and this error estimate here, the second term. You don't have to do a second lower or higher resolution to get a comparison from a convergence test. To validate it, I've also done these tests at different numerical accuracies, so I can do a standard convergence test for validation of these. And the validation actually looks very nice for the most part. If you focus, say, on the green points in this graph, you'll see that basically the two error estimates agree. This so-called internal estimate is typically about a factor of between 1 and 10 smaller one in 10 larger than the convergence test estimate, which for historical reasons I call the record playback estimate here. So that's fine. That says the error estimate's a bit conservative, but that's okay. that's using double extended floating point precision. Using double precision, everything's fine down to about here. The blue points, you see these red points scatter all over the place. That's basically because there you're getting below a tenth of a part per million, and at that level, floating point round off is killing you at double precision. For the double extended, you have another factor of 1,000, so that would put the danger point down around there. So by doing the, even if I'm never going to go that low, by doing the extended precision computation, I've now quantified the point at which floating point round off errors are a concern. So I now know that, for instance, if I want to get to one part per million, I probably don't need extended precision arithmetic. Before I go on to talk about more error estimates, I should just give an overview of what the modes and their error estimates look like. The individual modes follow the sort of standard picture that you've seen a lot of times before. They fall right on the predicted large L expansion to within much less than one pixel of the computer on that graph. The error estimates have a lot of interesting structure, which it's worth very briefly looking at. Focus here first on the green points. So these are the error estimates for a set of evolutions of the various values of L. And you see they have this sort of stepped structure. What's going on there is the mesh refinement algorithm is responding to the increasing difficulty of the problem with increasing L by adding extra refinement levels, which happen in power of 2 steps. And in the unlikely event there's time, I'll come back to these red points at the end. When one then sums the self-force modes to get the numerical sum, it's not obvious how to estimate the error in the numerical sum, because all these numerical modes came from the same code. So you have no way of knowing if their numerical errors are, in fact, statistically independent, in which case you'd sum them in quadrature, or statistically perfectly correlated, in which case you should sum the errors arithmetically. So to find out, I've tried doing it both ways and correlated them both against the convergence test estimates to see which matches up better. And the results are quite clear. The quadrature sum is better. The quadrature sum are these points falling right along the diagonal. The arithmetic sum are consistently about a factor of 3 pessimistic. So you don't need to add the arithmetic sum errors. You can add them in quadrature. Interestingly enough, that continues to be true even for errors which are small enough where the individual modes are quite inaccurate. I think what's happening is we're computing a lot of modes and averaging them. You can do the same sort of issues come up for the tail fit. I probably don't have time to talk about that, but I should mention the tail fit is actually numerically quite ill-conditioned. You get condition numbers that are as high as 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9 in some cases. It turns out, though, that if you just renormalize the tail fit basis functions so that they all have unit value somewhere in the middle of the range where you're doing the fitting, that problem basically goes away. The tail fit errors, again, I've compared can we use the standard statistical formula versus a worst-case formula that assumes the errors are perfectly correlated and anti-correlated in such a way as to maximize the fitting area. Again, I found that the standard statistical formula seems to give reasonable approximations to reality, and the worst-case formula is overly pessimistic. So in some sense, the lesson of this part of the talk is you can get away with doing the easy thing and pretending that they're statistically independent. Just to give you a sense of the tail fit results, the tail fit chi-squares basically are small for large error thresholds. Eventually, they start to climb because of floating point round-off error limits again. In fact, you can see the residuals actually start to go back up at the very smallest error tolerances in the code in double precision. In extended precision, they drop more slowly. Skipping over that, I guess the last set of The last set of error tests I should show you are comparing the overall estimated error of the self-force against the actual error, which we can get by comparing from, again, Detweiler, Messer, Taki, and Whiting's very accurate frequency domain values. And you see they're basically dead on. So this is confirming that we have a reliable and robust set of error estimators, which is one of the key things I was trying to accomplish here, because I can then make use of these in eccentric orbits where I don't have an analytical value to fall back on, or a frequency domain value. And quick overview of the best results. They're very nice. They're better than a tenth of a part per million. Around the tenth of a part per million level, the agreement between the internal error estimators and the actual error estimators starts to fall apart. So I don't want to really claim that I'm better than a tenth of a part per million. The code is actually currently, the highest accuracy results take a bit less than a CPU year running on a dozen processors or so. All my numerical parameters are tuned for the highest accuracy case. So actually the code's quite slow at modest accuracies. The way I need to tune the parameters, use not quite so grossly large problem domain sizes, vary the AMR error tolerances with L, so that because you don't have to solve accurately modes which only contribute a tiny amount to the self-force. I could get away with solving fewer than those. So I'm in the process now of backing off these parameters and seeing how far I can back them off. I can probably speed up the modest accuracy calculations by another order of magnitude that way. So basic conclusions are some sort of mesh refinement is very valuable if you're going to do time domain computations, if you're going to do finite differencing. The spectral methods might be another alternative. You can get an internal error estimate essentially for free in this sort of calculation that doesn't need mesh refinement. It's safe to treat different modes' error estimates as uncorrelated and use the Stats 101 formulas. The tail fit needs to be renormalized to avoid a serious ill-conditioning problem. And for my code, floating point round-off limits things to about a tenth of a part per million, which I'm happy with. But it's useful to know where the limits are so I don't bump into them accidentally in other calculations. And the last thing is, because I'm getting beautiful agreement with these highly accurate frequency domain results, which are computed by a totally different calculation, this gives a very stringent test that not only are both codes correct, but both theories are correct. By pushing that validation of one method against the other, by pushing the error floor on that down, we improve our sensitivity to detect small, low-level errors in one formalism or another. And I guess the last thing I should say is, I have seen no sign of the JOST junk solutions, which have been talked about. I don't know why, but I see no sign of them. I mean, I would think that if they were there, I'd be seeing them at the tenth of a part per million level, but I don't see them. Almost everything I've said can be found in more detail in a paper which I submitted to GRQC Friday night, and which will be in the public announcement on either tonight or Monday night. Thank you.
We have time for a very brief comment or a very quick question.